Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn. This is Late Night Live, where Philip Adams shares ideas, stories and opinions with the finest minds from around the world.
Welcome to Late Night Live, tonight in the form of a public debate, part of an international conference on moral philosophy hosted by the University of Notre Dame. And because of my sudden proximity to God, I have to make a confession. This is not our normal studio. I was here a few weeks ago with my 16-year-old daughter marvelling at a production of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. In a couple of weeks, this will become the setting for Keating, the musical we had to have. The current production, for which on left and right you see scraps of the set, is The Happy Prince by Oscar Wilde. It is not a depiction of the University of Notre Dame. I'm now going to introduce two leading philosophical minds who are more than qualified to grapple with our question, is God necessary for morality? After we hear from each of them for 15 minutes, I'd propose chatting with them, and then there should be time to take questions from the audience, and the microphones are down the front. We will turn the lights up a little later so you won't fall to your deaths as you seek them out. I am, of course, I'm entirely neutral on this debate. I am a faithist, and that's someone with a deep faith in atheism. Our first guest speaker puts the affirmative case that God is indeed necessary for morality, and it's John Haldane. John is Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Centre for Ethics, Philosophy and Public Affairs at the University of St Andrews in Scotland. He's also held one of those named chairs, the Royden Davis Chair in Humanities at Georgetown, the Stanton Lecture in Divinity at the University of Cambridge, and he's lectured at various other universities. And this is impressive. He's a consultant to the Pontifical Council for Culture and the author of numerous books, including An Intelligent Person's Guide to Religion and Faithful Reason and Reasonable Faith. Our second speaker, who will present his case positively in the negative, is Dr. Raymond Gaita, Professor of Moral Philosophy from King's College London at the University of London and Professor of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University. His books include Good and Evil, An Absolute Conception, A Common Humanity, Thinking About Love and Truth and Justice, and that incomparable book, Romulus, My Father, which was transmogrified into one of the best Australian films I've ever seen. John, if you wouldn't mind, the pulpit is yours.
It occurred to me with that introduction and the reference to the Pontifical Council that in anticipation, I suppose, of a papal visit before too long, it's possible that somebody in the Vatican will be interested in what the outcome of this debate might be. In fact, I've just referred to it as being a debate, and it's advertised as such. In fact, I think of it more as a conversation, and I expect that's how it will, in fact, develop. Both Ray Gaita and I are professional philosophers who've given a good deal of thought to these sorts of issues over the years, and anybody who does that very quickly comes to be dissatisfied with short, brief answers that typically fail to capture the depth of the issue. So I hope that we will get somewhere in exploration of that, but not so deep as not to come to the surface again. A question such as, is God necessary for morality, invites from a philosopher, as most serious questions do, the reply, it depends what you mean. And in this case, it depends what you mean by necessary, and it depends what you mean by morality. It also, I suppose, depends what you mean by God. And in fact, I'll be touching on the thought that some people have had, that it's not so much that God is necessary for morality as that religion is necessary for morality. So that's one initial thought that the question itself admits of some further clarification. And I'll be coming to that in due course and saying something about what necessary and morality in this context might mean. The second initial thought that occurs to me is this, that there is behind this question a background assumption, or perhaps set of assumptions. This question isn't being posed here, I think, in a purely abstract form, in a way that people might speculate in an entirely academic way. I guess the background is something like this, that whereas it was once widely the case that private and public ethics were faith-based, we seem to be living, particularly in the developed world, in a period in which people have moved away from that, a matter that some regret and some welcome. And so in answering this question, I suppose it has to be borne in mind that there are those who would wish to see it answered in one way rather than another way, in the hope of either reintroducing religion into ethics or indeed further expelling it. So with those two thoughts in the background, let me begin, if I may, with a quotation. The source of this quotation is the British Prime Minister of past years, Harold Macmillan. Like most British Prime Ministers, and I suspect like most leaders in the Western world in the 20th century, Macmillan was a Christian. In fact, he took with him into the trenches in the First World War, in which he served, a copy of the New Testament. At any rate, later in life, he chose to reflect on the matter of the place of religion in his own life and in the life of the nation as he understood it. And he wrote as follows: "Whatever your views happen to be about practical theology, I don't think a nation can live without religion. If you don't pray every night, and if you don't believe in God, and if you don't think you can serve God eventually, you can't solve all these problems, and you can't even survive them. When you give up religion, you give up any kind of idealism." Now, I want to come back and consider the later part of that. When you give up religion, you give up any kind of idealism. But let me start with the more immediate thought, not so much about idealism, but about morality. And just consider some ways in which it might be thought that morality requires either the existence of God or, at any rate, a belief in the existence of God. The first way in which that might be thought to be the case is this, that the very content of morality, what morality delivers to us, what it's about, the force that it has, and so on, reveals its very religious or divine source. This thought, I suppose, goes somewhat like this, that when we think about morality, what we see it consists of is a number of absolute rules, prohibitions or requirements, things that one must or must not do. And the question would be, how could there be such a set of rules? Well, one thought would be there's such a set of rules because we've made them up. But morality seems to stand beyond human invention as something that might criticize it. And so it looks as if we face in morality a system of rules or requirements that are not of our own making, but have a kind of commanding force. And the thought would be, where could that come from but from a legislator? But if this is beyond humanity, then it certainly isn't a human legislator, and so perhaps it's a divine one. Now, I'm not myself particularly attracted to this line of reasoning, in part because I don't think it captures exactly the character of morality, and in any case, philosophers have supposed there might be other ways of explaining how, even if morality does consist of a set of laws, how that might be without reference to religion. So let me move on to consider a different way in which it might be thought that morality has religion standing behind it, and necessarily so, and that's psychological. The thought here is just this: people will only be motivated to do the right thing, only be motivated to live good lives, if they have behind them the prospect of reward, or ahead of them, I should say, the prospect of reward and of punishment. And again, it seems to me that this isn't obviously so. There are plenty of people who seem to live moral lives, or certainly to be concerned with morality, whose motivation in that has got nothing to do with the prospect of reward or of punishment. A particular version of this idea that morality is required, religion is required to motivate us morally, is one that might appeal to people who are interested in markets and economics, and it's this, that social interactions depend upon trust. One of the classic problems in societies is that of free riders, people who take the benefit of social arrangements without actually contributing to them. If a free rider is very clever, they can conceal the fact that they're doing this from their fellows, and that way they escape sanction and punishment. But if they believe there is a God who oversees all of this, then they know, or they believe they know, that they will receive that punishment, and therefore appeal to religion here might be a way of grounding trust, getting people to trust and cooperate for fear that if they don't do so, they'll be punished. And once again, I don't think this is a very good way of thinking about the matter. People can be motivated towards trust without fear, and even if they were motivated by that fear, is that really a very fitting basis on which to introduce religion? So let me move finally to two further thoughts. One is this: morality can require us to sacrifice everything. There can be circumstances under which the only way of doing what is right, what the situation calls for, is one that involves enormous sacrifice. Perhaps not just the lives of those immediately involved, but those of their family or friends or society. It may seem at times that to do the right thing would involve the death or suffering of very large numbers of people. And one question might be this: how could it be like that? How could it be possible that life could ever require that? And one thought might be, if morality is underwritten by or has standing behind it a just God who will apportion what is due to those for the great sacrifice that they suffer and endure, then this would give it some kind of foundation and sense and would be a basis for hope, that people could live morally in hope that whatever sacrifices they incur or are borne by their loved ones, that somehow, at the end of the day, this will be restored. Well, I think there's something in that, but I want to end with a different thought. And the different thought is this: if we're going to talk about what it is to have a good human life, then we have to go beyond morality as a set of rules or requirements and start to think about what it is to explore human nature and to think about its fulfillment. And as we start to do that, two thoughts should occur to us. One is that for all we aspire to be good, we also behave badly, and sometimes very badly indeed. We sometimes are mired in evil. Where does that disposition, that inclination, come from? Equally, we seem to aspire to a condition beyond that which we ourselves can achieve. Where does that aspiration come from? And here's where religion offers an answer, and in particular, the Christian religion. Because on the one hand, it teaches, in the words of Augustine, that human beings suffer a darkness of the intellect and a disturbance of the passions, that their minds are snared in certain ways, darkened in certain ways, and that their appetites and desires drag them down at times. But equally, Augustine teaches that we are made for God and that we have within our hearts a desire for a kind of fulfillment that human beings cannot achieve, the human world cannot bring to pass. And in this understanding of life as having these existential dimensions, of, on the one hand, our aptitude for evil, on the other, our aspiration for salvation, that the only thing that explains that adequately and answers to it is a religious understanding of human beings. Thank you.
Thank you, John Haldane, and let me remind the listener, who is unfortunate to be with us at the Sydney Seymour Centre, that we're having an event which is part of an international conference on moral philosophy hosted by the University of Notre Dame. And I must say, I've got to be saved tonight because I feel myself on the verge of converting to Catholicism. So I hope that Ray Gaita... I hope that Ray Gaita will bail me out.
I don't think so. Because, like John, I don't think of this as a debate, and that might disappoint anybody who's come here for cultural combat, but I want to feel free to agree with him and he with me, because understanding is what matters. And to that end, I'll make certain observations and draw distinctions that I'll hope will make for a fruitful discussion. And I think it's probably in the discussion that the differences between John and I will become much clearer. But until then, you might wonder which side I'm on. Well, it's the relation between God and morality rather than the relation between religion and morality that's at issue. Throughout, I'll talk for the sake of convenience about morality as though it were one thing, which obviously it isn't. There are many moralities, none of which I think can be fully underwritten by facts or by reason. And some people distinguish nowadays between ethics and morality, partly because they identify morality with moralizing in the pejorative sense of the term. They prefer to bring the values that they admire under the concept of ethics. I have some sympathy with this, but there's no agreement on how to use that distinction between ethics and morality, so I'll continue to speak about morality. And also, for the sake of convenience, I'll speak sometimes just of religion, but always I'll mean religion of the kind that requires one to speak God's name in prayer and in worship, and that I can't do, which is why I don't think of myself as religious, though it seems that plenty of other people do. But in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the connection between prayer and the very notion of what it is to believe in God is so intimate that it would be absurd, I think, for a Jew or a Christian to say, I know God exists, but whether one should pray to him, well, that I haven't yet settled. So I'll just assume, and I take it to be obvious, that the division between morally good and serious people doesn't map neatly onto the distinction between people who believe in God and people who don't. And I take it as obvious that at least for the most part, I'll explain that qualification perhaps in discussion, morally good people who don't believe in God, people who care passionately for justice, virtue over vice, who have a strict sense of obligation or moral necessity, for whom it matters profoundly to live decently, indeed people for whom nothing matters so much as to live decently, where nothing really means nothing, I take that, for the most part, these people aren't living off intellectual capital borrowed from religion. Well, now to some of my observations. Many people think that if one doesn't believe in God, if morality is purely of human origin, then human beings must have created it to serve their purposes, purposes which, the value of which can be appreciated by any normal human being, safety, security, happiness, conceived from the perspective of an enlightened self pursuing its interests, for example. Morality, it must therefore, this thought continues, be assessed according to how well it serves those purposes and should be adapted when our purposes change or when circumstances make some of the means with which we've achieved them inefficient or obsolete. Irresistibly natural, though that chain of reasoning may seem, it's mistaken, I believe. The reason, to oversimplify a little by putting it into a slogan, is that morality is not the servant of our purposes, it's their judge. Hardly anybody believes that decent ends justify all necessary means to achieve them. Most people, at least, take seriously the belief that justice sometimes requires us to renounce the most efficient means to protect what we most value. But when we ask which means are morally available to us, we can't look to the purpose that morality serves because there's no such purpose. Were one to suggest, for example, that the purpose of morality is to secure social cooperation, then one will discover on reflection that it's morality that judges which forms of social cooperation we can decently enjoy. And the same is true of all the purposes that morality is alleged to serve, be it individual flourishing, self-realization, autonomy, happiness, the collective good, even the survival of the species. Morality will judge which forms of them and which means for their achievement are acceptable. And once one acknowledges that morality doesn't serve our interests but is their judge, one will be free of the illusion that if morality is of human origin, that it must always be able to adapt rationally and creatively to serve our interests. Freed from that illusion, one can acknowledge that morality and the world are not always suited to one another, and to do that is to do no more than to acknowledge tragedy. Sometimes we may be morally obliged to do what is morally terrible to do. Some people have recently argued, for example, that for torture on those grounds, saying that it's the lesser evil, meaning that that the lesser evil really is an evil. That means that they believe, as some people don't believe, that one can't justify an evil merely by pointing to the way in which it would avert a great, generate a great good or avert a great evil. And others, myself included, argued that torture is morally terrible to do and can never be counted as a lesser evil we're morally obliged to do. But none of these positions, I think, and this may be, will be a matter of dispute between John and me, none of these positions depend for their coherence on belief in God. Well, some people go further than denying that belief in God is necessary for morality. They actually say that belief in the omniscient and omnipotent Judeo-Christian God is incompatible with morality, that worship of him is inconsistent with an understanding and struggle against the evils of this world. And this, I'm sure you'll know, is an old debate, and I hope I don't sound high-minded if I say that I often find it distasteful. We know that people came out of Auschwitz with their belief in God intact, and some indeed with it deepened. They thank God for the grace which enabled them to retain a sense of his goodness, to worship and to praise him despite what they'd seen and suffered. Others, of course, came with their faith shattered, and some cursed God, some thought anything else was unintelligible, even obscene. I have no idea why one should think that detached philosophical thinking about the problem of evil should settle which of these is right. I don't even know what it is to say or to think that one of these might be right and the other wrong. It would seem not only wrong, but I think more importantly presumptuous to believe that only those who came out of Auschwitz with their faith shattered fully understood the horrors that they saw and suffered. Presumptuous in the same way that some pacifists are presumptuous when they claim that only they see the true horror of war. I don't believe that there's an independent, non-question-begging account of what it is to have really seen the horrors of Auschwitz, really to have appreciated their full significance, that could convict those who retained their faith after Auschwitz, convict them of a failure to understand. And for that reason, I find distasteful the idea that any clear-headed person should be prepared to hold God to account for failing adequately to manage the universe to the moral standards of something that looks like utilitarianism, especially if that means advancing, in a spirit of sweet reasonableness, hair-raising suggestions about what God might reveal to us in heaven concerning the providential role he assigned to Auschwitz. Skipping quite a bit here. Coming back now to morality, I said before that it's obvious that one can be a morally good person without believing in God, but there are people who think that morality will always be vulnerable to a serious kind of moral scepticism unless it has rational foundations, and providing God is one of the means of providing those foundations. What they fear is a kind of scepticism that morality is an illusion and that the concepts of justice and obligation and so on really answer to nothing. Well, I know nobody who really seriously believes this, not at any rate anybody who believes it or is inclined to believe it just because they've been convinced by argument of one sort or another. There are, of course, many people for whom morality means nothing at all, but they've not got to that position after reflection because after reflection they've found that it has no rational basis. Philosophers have been indeed haunted by this kind of scepticism ever since the days of Plato. There are characters in Plato who profess it, but generally they go off in a sulk whenever the argument gets tough, so they're hardly models of people who seek the truth fearlessly wherever it may take them, and that may indeed have been Plato's point. And on other occasions, philosophers raise the possibility, but in abstract ways, never being prepared to speak in their own name, never saying, I'm the kind of person who wish I could follow reason to the point where I'm prepared to accept morality is entirely an illusion. And there's a reason for this, I think, and which I'm just quickly sketch. A person who's morally serious can't think that morality is of marginal significance in her life. She may not think it overrides all other values, but she must take her moral concern as the most serious of her life. And now I think it's intrinsic to moral seriousness to the kind of seriousness morality must have for anybody who understands what it is, that a morally serious person must fear to fall into that kind of nihilism, fear to become the kind of person who would say, for me, it doesn't in the end matter, provided I'm faithful to reason, if I have to abandon morality. Well, because reason can't rightly be in conflict with a proper understanding of the nature of things, it can't be in conflict with a fear that I think is intrinsic to an understanding of morality to succumb to nihilism. Kierkegaard once expressed this really well. He said, just as a logician most fears a fallacy, so the ethical thinker most fears to fall away from the ethical. And this obviously has implications for the more general thought that perhaps without God, life will cease to have meaning, or its meaning will be fraught and attenuated and less deep. Obviously, that idea must entail, amongst other things, a propensity to the nihilism I've just spoken about. But of course, it includes much more, that meaning can't be sustained merely by the love of people, of institutions, of art, and the beauty of the world. I don't say that people can't fall into this kind of state because of the considerations of the kind I sketched a moment ago, but I don't think they can rightly claim that the threat to meaning is rationally necessitated by such considerations. To the contrary, those very same things can prompt one, as they did Albert Camus, to an affirmation of life, just as one's sense of the beauty of a blossom may become more intense with an appreciation of its fragility. Camus is best known for making Sisyphus an existentialist hero, someone who disdained false hope and false consolation as fiercely as the soldier in the first act of Aeschylus as Agamemnon, who says he wouldn't give a farthing for the mortal whom false hopes could set afire. The myth of Sisyphus begins with the astonishing claim that there's only one serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Even as a young man when I first read this, I believed that was posturing and that only muddle followed it. But even so, the myth of Sisyphus contains something finer than one finds in most of Camus' more clear-headed critics. And to find it at its best, one should go to the lyrical essays on Algerian cities and on the desert in Iran. Nowhere is Camus' tragic humanism more attractive than in his celebration in those lyrical essays of the loves of the young men and women of Algiers. And nowhere is the celebration of the yearning for happiness, whose fulfilment is always short-lived, more tenderly qualified by a sense of the tragic, made all the more heart-rending by the poetic beauty of its expression. And those essays are marked thoroughly throughout by an intensity about what it means to live truthfully that now seems alien to us. It would be a mistake to assume that in Camus it's merely another expression of the intensity with which French intellectuals characteristically respond to philosophical questions about meaning, value, and purpose. When it's authoritative rather than grandstanding, the intensity of the myth of Sisyphus is the expression of Camus' fearful love of the world, fearful because he's always conscious of the many ways he might betray it. Camus' need for lucidity, the word appears often in his writings, is not a response to abstract philosophical doubts. It expresses his need to be faithful to his love of the beauty of the world, as does his rejection, in the end, of the kind of suicide that would leave the world as though it were a smoke-filled room, as Kant once put it. Camus writes scornfully against people who disdainfully turn their back on the world, especially if they want to make an aesthetic or a morality or even a philosophy or religion out of it. Despite his torments, his Sisyphus discovers a joy that's an expression of an unconditional love of the world. And like everything else, this love is vulnerable to misfortune. To think otherwise would be hubris, for at any moment we can lose everything that gives sense to our lives. If it's a lucid and unconditional love of the world, it must acknowledge that affliction could destroy it. But because severe affliction can destroy everything in a person, its power to destroy a person's love of the world does not mean that that love was not unconditional.
This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. And we are here under the auspices of the University of Notre Dame. Well, I'm Philip Adams, a dilapidated broadcaster. Sitting beside me is is John Haldane, Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Centre for Ethics, Philosophy and Public Affairs at the University of St Andrews, and Raymond Gaiter, Professor of Moral Philosophy from King's College in London and Professor of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University. Okay, I also feel a bit like a mangy old lion in a den of Christians, and and so what I want to do is to speak for someone who lives in a universe without an author, without a purpose, where the only destiny is the final outcome of the second law of thermodynamics, where I do not face the prospect of reward or punishment, just the certainty of the personal annihilation provided by death. I would have thought, and I put this to you, if I may, John, that someone in my position who lives a meaningless life, ultimately, probably may have a greater need to create a meaning for him or herself in that void, and that someone like me might even be propelled towards morality, a personal morality, albeit, because of that quite extraordinary sensation of aloneness.
So in a way, this touches on the question that Ray was concerned with also, which is the tragic condition, or what may be the tragic condition of humanity when it looks upon the world and is unable to resolve matters in ways that would seem satisfactory, and yet tries to find meaning within the context of that. So I think that maybe one way of responding to what you are saying is this, is to make the connection back, if I may, with the quotation from Macmillan, just to make this.
It's the nastiest quotation I've heard in years.
Well, there we go. Let's see how we get on with that. What I find interesting about the Macmillan quotation is that it begins by talking about morality and ends by talking about idealism. That's to say, he begins talking about morality in a rather conventional sense of a set of rules and so on, or hinting at that and such like, but then talks about religious practices like prayer and belief and the way in which those might be expressed, and thinks that you can't, as it were, begin to tackle what lies ahead of you without having some kind of idealism. Now, this is the case of somebody, obviously, charged with enormous responsibilities. You're talking about the condition that many more people will find themselves in, or just trying to get through in a way, or trying to salvage something from it, or make something from it, and so on. But I think that's the human condition in general. That's to say, each and every one of us may find ourselves in circumstances of severe vulnerability, a sense of isolation, a sense of limitation, and so on. And what I'm interested in is what religion has to say about that. Not the idea that it just rushes in with comfort, because part of what it may rush in with is something that may underline one's vulnerability. That's why I was talking, for example, about the way in which religion exposes the darkness of human life and doesn't set it aside as something that is merely an artifact of social circumstances and so on, but something that may be written into the human soul. So what I really want to say is that what Macmillan and his concern was touching on, and perhaps what you were touching on, and in a way what Ray, with his quotations from Camus, was touching on, is something about the human condition and its very nature. And what I think religion offers, and perhaps only religion offers, is a deep account of that nature that both reveals to us the source of the potential for evil, but also makes sense of the aspiration as not just an expression of desperation, not a cultural artifact, but something real. To quote Augustine, "You made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they come to rest in you." It's that sense of restlessness that I'm interested in.
Ray?
I first heard this talk about the third law of thermodynamics. It was C.P. Snow who used to describe it as part of the tragic vision of life. I remember an interview with C.P. Snow with Ludovic Kennedy years and years ago in Britain on television. And Snow expressed this view and said it's part of the tragic view of life. And Kennedy said, why is it tragic? And Snow said, I remember, because what it means is that it all runs down into porridge in the end. Ludovic Kennedy said, oh, God, when? And Snow said, oh, well, in a few billion years. And Kennedy said, oh, good. But look, this, because, I mentioned this because there are very banal versions of that thought, and C.P. Snow's was, I think, as in fact there's a, they say, that's much celebrated by Bertrand Russell, called A Free Man's Worship. But I don't want to deny, though I have to say I have no inwardness with this myself. I don't want to deny first of all, obviously, the thought of death, and perhaps more the thought of the death of loved ones, and then maybe too the much more abstractive thought about everything that human beings have created and striven for. Must perish. I don't deny that can create a kind of estrangement from things in the world that matter to them. But to the extent that it does, it's not because in any way reason forces this on anybody. So if anybody feels that estrangement on account of these things, I don't think that person can say, OK, give me reason now why I should feel differently. Give me a rational basis. But I have to say, I feel no inwardness with this at all. It terrifies me that some of the people I love are going to die. But for me, that testifies to the sense of meaning. It's an expression of the meaning, that terror. If it was meaningless, there wouldn't be that terror. And I'm sure you feel the same about one's horror at the sense of injustices and evils in the world. This isn't something that generates a sense of meaningless. This is a heightened, intense sense of meaning.
Surely all of us can have that sense, irrespective of whether or not one believes in a God. I like the word numinous, and I can assure you that despite the fact that I live in a meaningless world, when I walk out at night and look at the stars above the homestead at the farm, I am as overwhelmed by that sense of awe and astonishment and, yes, dread, as any Christian or any Hindu. And that is, I think, common to us all, and that perhaps sometimes we greatly exaggerate the difference that religious faith brings to the human experience.
It's usually what it brings as an interpretation. So we've been speaking just now about certain aspects of human sensibility, what it is that human beings feel in the face of certain possibilities, their own death, the death of loved ones, suffering, and so on, the frustration of not merely ambitions, but deep projects to which they're morally committed and whose real value they believe in, and so on. The question is there anything to be understood here about the nature of this sensibility, about this, well, the delicacy of feeling, the sense of hope, but also the fear of loss? And here I think it's important to add something that I don't think has quite been made explicit so far, which is this. Just as I said, we can think about in what sense necessary and in what sense morality, we also have to think about in what sense God. And sometimes people talk about God as if this was just a generalized idea, and everybody who believed in God believed in that. But it depends on the kind of God you believe in. And I take it that in the particular case that I'm concerned with, the Christian God is part of that human experience, shared in that sensibility and that suffering and those fears and so on, through the incarnation, through the person of Jesus Christ and so on. So it's the datum, the shared sense of human capacity for feeling of certain sorts, for hopes of certain sorts and so on, calls out for, I'm inclined to say, an interpretation. Now, maybe there isn't an interpretation. Maybe there's just more description of it. Maybe one just says, this is what human beings are like. But it would be inappropriate, I think, to foreclose on the possibility of an interpretation that makes sense of that and then carries it forward into something else.
I often end letters or emails to people who write to me trying to persuade me to embrace this or that faith. Let's not let a little thing like God come between us. Let me now eliminate God entirely from the discussion, just for a moment or two. If my fellow atheist, faithist Dawkins was here tonight, he would be introducing an argument which I haven't heard even hinted towards, and that is that perhaps forms of morality predate human existence by thousands and millions and perhaps billions of years. He would argue that there is evidence in evolution at various levels that altruism is as powerful a force as the much more often advertised violence, which is seen as a part of Darwinian theory. Living on a farm, I'm constantly overwhelmed by observations of the tenderness of mothers, the mothers of calves and foals and joeys and puppies and chickens. And if you want to see altruism and self-sacrifice, study a beehive, you know, where these extraordinary and gifted little creatures will happily give up their own lives for the cause of the community. So I put this to you, Ray. Is it not possible that morality is simply a very sensible outcome of an infinitely long evolutionary process?
I don't want to deny the evolutionary origins of all sorts of dispositions, sort of moral dispositions. Altruism is often mentioned, and compassion and so on. I think this is just an empirical matter, and I don't know what the answer is. And it's mostly a hell of a lot of just speculation, as far as I can see. But I have no reason to deny it. But there's a big difference, it seems to me, between the kinds of things you described, like the tenderness of animals to their young and so on, and tenderness of beings for whom who have reflective lives in such a way as to actually determine the nature of that kind of tenderness. Sorry, that was a very clumsy sentence. What I'm trying to say is it's essential to a lot of the things that we count as virtues and vices. It's essential to a lot of what we count as our inner life, our love and so on, that we distinguish between real forms of it and false forms of it. You know, real love from infatuation, courage from recklessness and so on. This we tend to think, and I think we're right to think, is of the very nature of those dispositions that's not available to animals. I'm not someone who says animals can't think, but animals don't, for example, wonder about whether it's been really compassion they've shown to their kittens as opposed to some self-serving maternal instinct, etc., etc. So. It's certainly true, and Dawkins is really good at this. If you have a reductionist sense of what morality is in the first place, a really thin and trivial sense of it, then any kind of evolutionary theory will account for it. Have a shallow enough sense of what altruism is, even souls are ants turn out to be altruistic. It doesn't help them.
John, do you give that ex-cleric in England, Mr. Darwin, do you give him any credit for discovering another mechanism that perhaps is as important as faith?
Well, thank you, because I wanted to come in on that. Look, I think here I want to pick up something that Ray was saying, not in his immediate remarks just now, but in something he said earlier on, which seems to me highly relevant to this. The question is not so much the comparison that might be made, though I follow this as well, about the relationship between, say, animal behaviour of the sort that you were describing and, say, human behaviour. Somebody might think that just differs in complexity, let's say, even if there is a difference here. But I took Ray to be saying at an earlier stage that appeals to explanations of religion, of morality in terms of the purposes that it might serve, the benefits that it might provide, whether those be socio-economic or ones of sort of personal conscience or whatever else it may be, are vulnerable to this thought that if somebody says, well, look, here's an advantage that this confers, and that might be part of an evolutionary story, we've got it because it conferred these advantages on our ancestors and so on, we have to ask the question, but is this good? I mean, for us, it's a question as to whether or not something that confers a certain selectional advantage and so on is something that we want to make part of our lives, to embed within our reflective lives and so on. So if it turns out, for example, that morality or religious belief backing up morality confers certain advantages in the marketplace, we might still want to ask, do we want to have that? Do we want to behave in that kind of way in the marketplace? So Ray's point, I take it, and this I want to endorse, is this, that morality is not so much explained in terms of purposes as morality judges purposes that might be proposed as part of the explanation for it. So we come back to this idea, we're reflective beings who find ourselves moved in certain ways, drawn in certain ways, both good and bad, and I want to try to understand why that is. And something about our evolutionary history isn't going to either endorse or disconfirm, reinforce and so on those things. They're open to reflection. And it's where one goes once one begins on that reflection. And this is where there may be the difference between us.
John, you've also written about the deintellectualization of the church. This is the marketplace, if you like, that in a sense the church has dumbed itself down in order to maintain its appeal to the masses. Is this disturbing you?
Yes.
In other words, I think you'd get a better audience amongst a lot of well-informed atheists than you would if we were having this discussion in one of the deep southern states of George Bush's America.
Well, I'm sure these are well-informed theists as well as well-informed atheists. Amusing as that may seem, I don't think it quite gets to the depth of it. I mean, what my concern there was that I think that this is part of a quite pervasive and general trend within our culture to be satisfied with quick and easy answers and to convert what ought to be serious reflection into other kinds of things. And that's traceable, dare I say it, to the influence of the media, including broadcasting media. But it is... It's something that surrounds us. Now, I've got a particular view about why it occurs within religious groups. I think it's partly that they're fearful, precisely the kinds of challenges that you might want to present, which I think there are robust replies, that they are fearful that, in fact, if they're exposed to this, it's going to expose the whole thing as being a kind of fraudulent show, a myth and superstition. So what I want to say is, look, reflect on these things and you'll see that they're not myths, they're not superstitions, or at any rate, you'll be better placed to address those questions. So that's why I want a reintellectualization of people of faith, but I want a reintellectualization of people in general.
Ray, you... Ray, you make a distinction between the God of religion and the God of philosophers. Can you address that?
Yeah, I take it that for a person whose God is the God of religion, that person must think that religion deepens her sense of things that matter in life, and that this is just a kind of a truth about the nature of religion. It would be, for such a person, it would be a kind of contradiction to be able to say something like, I know it's sentimental, I know it's banal, I know it does the dirt on life, it's disdainful of everything that really matters to human beings, but there you are, it's my religion. It doesn't matter to me. I'm interested in truth, not in these ascetic categories as to whether it's banal, for example. And so I've often remarked that it's the banality of the thought that if God's omniscient, he must know my email address, that undermines it rather than anything, so to speak, in logic. But what that really means then, if this is true, this is especially true for religions like Christianity and Judaism and Islam. Whose sacred texts constantly hold up examples to us upon which we're to meditate, and such that the meditation will deepen our sense, not only of what's religiously significant, but what it is for something to be religiously significant. And that's why it seems to me someone can't say, look, I know this translation makes what Jesus say terribly banal and tone-deaf to irony, but again, that doesn't matter. I'm not interested in literature. I'm interested in the truth. Whereas the God of the philosophers, I take it, is a philosopher sustained by speculation, which is deliberately in a kind of tone-free zone. Of which it says it's as inappropriate to ask, is this sentimental or is it banal, as it would be to ask that of a mathematical proposition in maths or physics. But that this now, I think, has an impact. I'm not religious, I really am. but this has, I think, an important consequence also for people who say things, who think they're atheists. So I don't mean who think they're atheists, who say they're atheists. It wasn't a Freudian slip.
Freud gets into the argument.
But who say things that they're deeply moved by the beauty of some religious practices or by the beauty of religious art or music, let's say Bach. Because if they then say that's merely an aesthetic matter, then they're making the same mistake as the person who says, well, it's merely an aesthetic matter, this translation, what Jesus says makes it sound so banal. In this case, banality is not an affront to an aesthetic sensibility. It's a form of the false.
As someone who has always viewed religion, all religions, with a sort of anthropological detachment, let me now put this to you, if I might, John. If God is necessary for morality, why doesn't religion do a better job being moral? I look at 2,000 years of human history and see oceans of blood produced very largely by religious disputation, often not between religions, but even within religions. The morality doesn't seem to be working very well.
Thank you. So two things about that. First of all, it's worth pointing out the things that religion has contributed. And I'm not just thinking of, you know, the obvious cases of aid to people and so on, but Western civilization was redeveloped in the period prior to the Middle Ages by the re-establishment of what we would think of now as civil society by the church. The creation of schooling systems, the creation of a welfare system, the creation of universities, of course, but also of hospital care and such like. Now, on the other side, as you say, there is this in the past and there's this in the present. But on my account of matters, religion itself has its own contribution to explaining why religion itself can behave in this way because of these recurrent tendencies. I spoke earlier, quoting Augustine, the darkening of the intellect, the disturbance of the passions. Religion is not immune from those. Religion can pathologically turn back upon itself and distort its own purposes, just as human beings may do in other areas. But why religion may be, when it does that, is particularly destructive is because religion, say like sex, touches some of the deepest motivating powers in human beings. So if we want to try to understand religious cruelty, understanding it religiously sometimes gives us a deeper insight than will a secular, somewhat banal understanding.
That's it. That's it for this edition of Late Night Live. Now, please hold the applause. We will, in fact, after my associates put this to air, we're going to continue this conversation with the audience here at the Seymour Centre. There's going to be a prolonged period now of interrogation. They may be much tougher on you than I've been. I've been on my very best behaviour. And that will be put to air at some later date. Let me now thank our guests, John Haldane, Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Centre for Ethics, Philosophy and Public Affairs at the University of St Andrews, and Dr. Raymond Gaiter, Professor of Moral Philosophy from King's College London and the Catholic University. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.